Welcome to the perfect triangle. The perfect triangle is equilateral, three sides of the same length. In an angry bipolar world, three perfect sides reveal many truths.
Body, mind, and spirit.
Thought, word, and deed.
Conspiracy, propaganda, and truth.
Natural health, allopathic tyranny, and your body.
Freedom, globalism, and sovereign nations.
And now, the perfect triangle.
Holocaust is a term that originated in ancient times. It comes from the Greek words holos, meaning whole, and kaustos, meaning burnt. Typically, the term Holocaust was used in reference to the pagan Jews in their Old Testament rituals when they sacrificed children on fires to their deity Molech. Whole children were thus burnt. Aside from Old Testament-related literature, the word Holocaust reappeared again in 1919, just after World War I. At that time, some prominent American Jews first began claiming in magazine articles that 6 million Jews were dying in a Holocaust in Europe at that time. This claim of a Jewish Holocaust in Europe shortly after World War I was even made by no less than the former Jewish governor of New York. Accordingly, such claims quickly spread until finally contained several years later. A little over three decades after the first claim of 6 million Jews dying in Germany, Ilya Ehrenberg, a prominent Jew of the Soviet Union, again announced in 1942 that 6 million Jews had been killed in World War II Germany. At the time of the second claim made by Ehrenberg, most Jews had not even been sent to German prison camps. And of course, the war was far from over. Ehrenberg continued to make these claims. It is believed by some that his statement was used to substantiate the long-held argument of 6 million still used today. With such matters easily believed due to the viciousness and hostility created in war. Despite such claims, however, it is noted that there is no master list of 6 million Jewish names anywhere. Even today, 60 years after the war, although this number of 6 million is still repeated today. Many international scholars who have researched the facts are convinced that, altogether, 1 million Jews might have died during World War II. This would then explain why there is an actual list of about 1 million Jews who died during the course of World War II on the Internet. Some, although, have pointed out that the census figures of Jews contradict the claim of 6 million Jews who died during World War II. In a 1938 census with figures provided by the American Jewish Committee, it was estimated that there were 15,748,091 Jews in the world. 10 years after this, in 1948, the census estimated that there were 15,753,638 Jews alive.
I'm Father James Mortley, about to get kicked off YouTube. I've reached a point where I can't go deeper into these things without discussing the Holocaust. And this involves the choice between truth and lies, between Christ the King and the globalist, Zionist, Antichrist totalitarianism. And I'll give two clear examples of where discussion is needed, but also why my channel will get banned. The first point is the number of people who died in Auschwitz. In 1945, the Soviets put out a propaganda film and it said 4 million people had died there.
4 million people lost their lives at Auschwitz.
This was the figure used at the Nuremberg trials, and you can see here a plaque from 1967 at Auschwitz saying 4 million people died here. But today, the broadly accepted figure, even by Yad Vashem and the Holocaust Memorial and the museum in Auschwitz, is 1.1 million people lost their lives there. The second point is about the death toll at Majdanek. The Soviets in 1944 said 2 million people were killed there. Very soon afterwards, this figure started to come down, so that by 1992, the claim was that 235,000 people had died there. Today, the mainstream consensus is that 78,000 people, most of them Jews, died in Majdanek. Now, these points raise some vital questions. Why is it that the figures were so inflated at the end of World War II? And why, if you ask about them, are you called a Holocaust denier or genocidal?
Never again will 1.5 million Jewish children be turned into soap and ash and lampshades. Never again!
We are being blackmailed by the Holocaust scary tale repeated here again and again. This is wrong. Israel is a terrorist state.
The time is over.
¿El trabajo más duro que has hecho?
Más duro, en la playa. Trabajar en la playa. Que de por la mañana hasta por la noche.
¿Recogías arena?
Y me acuesto el sur, allá para abrir el restaurante que era el arroz. Y me llama el cocinero. ¡Risita! ¿Qué? Ve por la paellera. Venga, que las 2 de la tarde ya están aquí. Mira el bañador. En la chancla. Todo despeinado porque no me dio tiempo de nada ponerme la chancla. Y el bañador. Voy a la playa, había subido la marea. Jesús. Había subido la marea y encontré una paella. Y la encontré porque te estaba la paellera agarrada. Entre metí entre las piedras de Chipiona, de Faro. Y cuando entro en el restaurante me ve el cocinero con una paellera y adentro la vende paella. ¡Asómate! ¡Asómate! ¡Mira dónde llega el agua! ¡Llegaba el agua hasta el restaurante! ¡Había subido la marea! ¡Ay! ¡Eso! ¡Ay, qué hacemos! ¡Qué hacemos ahora! ¡Con los dos sacos largos! ¡Ay, llama, llama para Sevilla! ¡Llama a Sevilla! ¡Que traigo paella! ¡Ay, mira! ¡Eso hizo con el bañado! ¡Con el bañado y con la paella! ¡Ay, el cocinero! ¡No vea! ¡A Sevilla! Y me y al último que cuando ya salió la bien de regla, estamos llorando. Oh, oh. Me cobró el tío la me cobró a 500 metros. Y ya no fui más. Me fui andando a cuello amarillo hasta hoy. Eso. Me mando por la noche, había bajado más el agua y por la mañana había subido. quién andaba vomitando la paellera, a ver, a lo mejor está en el barco ese del petróleo.
En el Prestige.
En el Prestige ese. Y ya no trabajé más la cocina. Ya aburrí sin la cocina. No cobré nada, me dieron el dinero del bote.
Now regret saying death gone free on Jewish people. Are you sorry you said that?
No.
Nothing matters. You should be.
Absolutely not.
You should be.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, but yeah, you should be.
Absolutely not.
When you insult the Jewish people and say you're going death gone free on the Jewish people, that is as racist as anything you say you've been through and any pain that you've experienced. It's the same thing. Racism is racism. And you know that, I think, don't you?
Yeah, obviously, that's why I said it.
So you said it knowing it's racist?
Yes, I fought fire with fire.
They don't understand the things I say on Twitter.
The Holocaust is their God. 73% say essential to their Jewishness is remembering the Holocaust. Now, it used to be the Holocaust became a God. Do you ever hear the phrase, well, who's a Jew? Well, Hitler didn't distinguish between religious and non-religious. If Hitler didn't distinguish, that makes you a Jew. It used to be that God in the Torah decided who's a Jew. Now Hitler decides who's a Jew. It used to be that you can't question God. Now you can't question the Holocaust. Now, Holocaust deniers are bad, no question, but what about a God denier? You can be a godless person, you could question God, anything you can question in the Jewish religion, but not the Holocaust. Denying God used to be what put you outside of the camp. Now it's denying the Holocaust. Abraham, a father, went from town to town building altars to God. Now they go from town to town building Holocaust memorials.
If somebody tells me that they put 3 to 4 people in an oven and they were done in 20 to 30 minutes, totally cremated, then I just say that that person's lying because that's not humanly possible. They're lying. It doesn't make any sense. Why would you put a tattoo on somebody that you're about to cremate? There's no explanation of where all the fuel would come from. The infrastructure is not there. There's so much evidence. I just challenge you to look into it. If you look into it, you're going to see that there's a mountain of evidence on why this never could have taken place. Now, people will raise certain objections like, you know, what about all those giant piles of human hair? What about all the piles of shoes? That's the smoking gun. That's the proof. Well, not really, because you don't have to kill someone to get their hair. It doesn't make any sense. It takes months to get that skin emaciated. You know, you don't get that way overnight. A lot of people will tell you about going to Auschwitz and playing on the soccer team and acting in musicals and plays and spending the camp currency at the commissary and things like that. Now, what's the real Holocaust? Remember, Holocaust means whole burnt offering. You want to know what the real Holocaust is? The real burnt offering is going to be when all of these Jews go to hell for eternity. That's the oven that they ought to be worried about.
I'm Jewish.
No, that's a bit of a problem.
You will read the Talmud. You will worship Saturn. You will be circumcised. You will suck baby dicks. Come on, Goy. Make your mind up time. Come, be a Shabbos Goy. Huh? This is anti-Semitic. Oy vey.
White America, wake the fuck up. White America, wake the fuck up.
Yes, white America, white Canada, white Europe, wake the fuck up. That's very sound advice from crazy Kanye West, fight fire with fire. That is the missing element these days. You know, with everything the International Jew has done, you got to give it right back to him. Can't turn the other cheek and all that Schofield reference Bible nonsense. It's going to be a great show today. This is episode number 236 of The Perfect Triangle, May 16th, 2025. Got a legendary author and a man who has paid the price for being just an elite man of letters, scholar, the author of the Holocaust Encyclopedia. Germar Rudolph is joining Zach and myself today. Welcome, Germar. As that montage shows, perhaps there's no greatest example of the 6 million times of Jewish perfidy than the nonsense of the Holocaust. And they have milked that to the extent of, you know, sucking trillions with a T of dollars from weak-minded, weak-willed white and European countries, the United States. In fact, I was just reading that San Marcos, Texas, is really annoyed with Governor Hot Wheels, who clearly the Jew has something on Governor Hot Wheels that he does so much in service to Israel. In fact, San Marcos was just complaining, why should we have to send 4 million of our annual budget to Israel? And that is exactly right, but there's so much we can go into, and it's just insane. But welcome, and how are you doing? We're honored to have you back as a guest.
Well, thank you. Thank you for asking. I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me on your show.
That's great. So let me open up the website for the Holocaust Encyclopedia and put it on the show. Zach, in the meantime, how are you? What's on your mind, and what's your first question or discussion point for Germar?
Hey, G, it's a pleasure to be on, as always. Germar, it's fantastic to meet you. I've heard nothing but positive things about you. I very much enjoyed your debate that you did on the Jake Shields podcast. I think that was impressive. So I'm excited to talk about the Holocaust Encyclopedia today and maybe give some accounts of what you've experienced personally as you've opened up and spread this information to other people, what kind of reactions you've gotten, what kind of legal issues that you've dealt with. I think these things are really important for others to understand that are going to be joining in this information war that we find ourselves in. So I really appreciate that you've taken some of those risks that many are afraid to take.
Yes. One step at a time, of course. It has taken me 35 years to get where I am today. It was a one step at a time process. And I can't say that everything of it was voluntarily, but if the enemy burns the bridges behind you, there is only one way, and that is forward. And that's what I've chosen to go, rather than trying to sycophant my way back into some fold that I didn't feel like doing. I just keep going forward.
So what's astounding to me, Germar, is you're a PhD, clearly a highly intelligent, disciplined intellectual and researcher. And so did you begin the Holocaust Encyclopedia as part of your PhD studies or for your thesis? Or how did you decide to work on this?
No, absolutely not. I would say I had an interest in German history, everything excluding the Holocaust, while I was at university studying chemistry and physics. And it was just a hobby of mine, reading books. And toward the end of my master's thesis, I ran by pure chance into a book, Paul Rossini, who is considered the founding father of Holocaust revisionism. I read that and was shaken by it, but it didn't really make me do anything about it because it was history. I didn't feel competent to do anything in history. I was a chemist. I was just graduating chemistry. So what can I do about history? And then while I was starting my PhD thesis at the Max Planck Institute for Solid State Research in Stuttgart, I realized that this institute, plus the contract I had with them, is the perfect opportunity to research forensic questions on the Holocaust in my spare time. So I wasn't doing it as a PhD study, but I was doing it parallel to my PhD study. The interesting question of whether or not Zyklon B leaves any chemical traces in the masonry of the alleged homicidal gas chambers, and if so, whether you could find something to this day. So as I said, just a purely private research interest that I did in my spare time, but my contract with the Max Planck Society allowed me to use all the Institute's resources to do that, because the Max Planck Society is a society for the furthering of science, and every PhD student is actually encouraged to use all of the Institute's resources to do whatever private research fancy they may have besides their official thesis, because they want scientists to be passionate about being a scientist, not being stuck in a slot where the PhD supervisor has put you and just slog along what you're asked to do, but feel free, be inventive, be creative about your interests, about your pursuances of scientific interest. And of course, at the end of the day, when this research result got published, the Max Planck Society was not happy. They couldn't do anything about it because it was written in the contract that I was allowed to do it, but they didn't extend my employment. Neither did I want to extend it, because at that point there was a mutual disappointment in the way things were being handled. So my career as a chemist at that point had pretty much evaporated. There's the very first bridge that they burned behind me, not allowing me to do my final exam for my PhD, using a law that was enacted in Germany on the 1st of September of 1939 by Adolf the Hitler. And it is still on the books today. And they use that to deny people or withdraw academic degrees from people who have committed a crime using their academic credentials. And that is what they accused and eventually sentenced me of having done. The forensic research result was considered incitement to hatred of the masses, and I got slammed with 14 months in prison. And the law, the case law we have on that law says you have to have at least a conviction of a year or more. So they had to just go over the year level to make sure that they are then able to deny me my PhD degree. So that's what happened. My career was pretty much bust. And I went into turning this revisionist research forensic approach to history into a profession. I started a publishing company. And over the past 35 years that I've what I've been doing, publishing research this map, actually, if I may interrupt, is a little bit outdated because Sweden has joined the club.
Oh, really?
2022. And Slovenia is in the club partially. So it depends on how you do it. You can get slammed in the same as for the UK if you do anything that is considered to be inappropriate, derisive toward the Jews, and you can get slammed there too. So that map needs an update. But anyway, yeah, so it's not just Germany where doubting or contesting the mainstream narrative is illegal. There are way less countries in Europe where it is not than there are where it is. And interestingly, both countries who accuse each other of being Nazis and try to kill each other, the Russians and the Ukrainians, both countries have actually outlawed Holocaust revisionism, so much about them being Nazis. So anyway, so 35 years of research and publishing activity, the core of which has been published in the volumes of the Holocaust handbooks. Now, you either can pull up that site, holocausthandbooks.com, or sure. to show that these handbooks. Yeah, there you go. So the handbooks themselves, if you go on the books or tab in the menu and by volume, you see all the volumes there. There are 53 right now. I'm working on the 54th as we are speaking. And all of them, if you click on any one of them, are accessible free of charge as PDF. So we do that research, if you will, pro bono, so to say. Everyone can access it. If you scroll down, the PDF is displayed down below. There is at the bottom. Yeah, you can download it with the download button, or you can read it actually online right there further down. It's actually displayed there on the website. So everyone who wants to get access to that kind of information can easily access it anonymously, download it free of charge, and work with it. And we know that a lot of historians have made use of it, mainstream historians who don't want to be identified, don't want to burn their own career, but want to learn about it. And I've got feedback here and there from historians and from other scholars and influencers that they're very grateful for the series to be accessible online, free of charge, without anyone having to identify themselves, so that they can actually get access to that hard-hitting, very thorough, unparalleled research. Now, 53 volumes of it, filling a good part of 4 or 5 feet in a shelf, is TMI. It's too much information. You know, if you want to smarten up on everything revisionists have found out over the past three and a half, four decades, to read this would take you years, and by the time you've reached half of it, you probably have forgotten already what was written in the first of the volumes you read. To retain all this information is borderline impossible. Now, I have published these books, all of them. I've published them in German. I've published them in English. I've translated many of them from other languages into English or German. A lot of it is from the Italian historian Carlo Mattoni, who writes only in Italian. So a friend of mine, Jürgen Graf, has translated a lot until 2016. He kind of dropped out at that point, and I took over the translation work. And if you go through any of them, you see that they're not in the first edition. Several are in their third, fourth, fifth, sometimes sixth, seventh, eighth edition. So I've gone over these books over and over again. I'm the one in the world who knows that that information most intimately, most thoroughly. And even I, even though I kind of know which, you know, if you ask me what title is, which volume number is that title, I can tell you. If you tell me a volume number, I can tell you what the title is. And I can tell you what the rough contents is. So if I'm looking for certain information, I know where to go to. But this series is not, it's something that has grown organically over 35 years. So they aren't necessarily repetitions and updates in one book building up onto another one. And so I'm never quite sure a certain topic is covered to one degree or another in maybe 2, 3, 4 volumes. Where exactly is it? And certain witnesses with their statements are coming up in several volumes, and where do I find exactly the quote that I'm looking for? And I've gone over these books over and over again in my PDF files trying to find the exact quote or source or something, and sometimes it takes me going through 3, 4, 5 books before I find it. Really annoying work, and that's for me, who absolutely knows this stuff. So it had reached the point where we needed to find a solution to make that information more concise, more organized, more accessible. And the idea to make an encyclopedia came actually from Israel. They, in the year of 2021, I think one of their NGOs or government organization, can't remember anymore what it was, published their yearly report on worldwide anti-Semitism. In one section, there was about quote unquote Holocaust denial. And in the English language, they said something like that there is only one outlet left in the world that produces new and relevant material, and that is Gemma Rudolph's Castle Hill Publishers. That was the company's name as it existed until 2023, kind of went belly up now that we have restructured and reorganized. Anyway, and Gamma Rudolf has published, that's what they claimed, has published an Encyclopedia of the Holocaust, in parenthesis, denial, which at that point I hadn't. And I thought, well, what are they referring to? That makes no sense. But what I had issued back then, not too long ago before that, was a new edition of my lectures on the Holocaust, which is volume 15 of the series, which has an encyclopedic scope. It is organized, trying to cover the entire territory by chapter and subchapter. And it says in its description on the back cover that it has an encyclopedic scope. And I guess they didn't want to mention the book's title, because every time the enemy mentions one of our titles or activities, people will look it up and may get reeled in by us. So any mention that makes it identifiable is advertisement for us. Even bad news, there's no such thing as bad news in our business. Any news is good news because we get exposure. So they want to avoid that and mislabeled what I had published. I was annoyed by them lying because I hadn't published an encyclopedia. But a few months after that, I thought to myself, wait a minute. That's right. I hadn't done it. They're lying. But we should do it. That's exactly what we need to do. So I reserved the website, the domain name that you're looking at right now, holocaustencyclopedia.com, in early 2022, and tried to get my fellow revisionists who were still active in the field and had the sufficient knowledge to sign up to the project and help me write it. Now, back in 2022, I was struggling with my marriage, my family. It was kind of in a situation where it was falling apart. And I could not have devoted much time to the project at all. But then it did eventually fall apart, and I was all on my own, cut off from my family, and depressed. And when I'm in this kind of a situation personally, and I've been there before with bridges being burned behind me, that's always a depressing situation. And when on a private life, your family falls apart, your marriage falls apart, that's quite a bridge to burn, and that's not good. So I was depressed, and a friend of mine in Texas took me in, and he had just purchased not too long ago the entire series of Holocaust handbooks and said, had exactly made the same analysis. This is huge information. It's impossible to take it all in to retain it, and it is not organized in a way that it makes anything easily accessible. There are indices in the books, but they are only for names, not for topics for most of the books. So we need an encyclopedia. That's what he said. You're in here, you're with me. I'm going to keep your back free of all the troubles and bothers you may have. But you sit down and write the damn thing. And that was work therapy for me at that point, working basically 12 to 14 hours a day, 7 days a week for 5 weeks. That was a minor contributor. So right now the encyclopedia has 591 entries. We're on the fourth edition already after 2 years, not 1.5 years. Actually, we do, because it's print on demand, every time we have a major update and new contributions, we make a new edition. So we had the third edition in January, and just this month we issued the fourth edition. 591 contributions, and 8 of them are from a different author, originally from Thomas Dalton, may ring a bell. If you look at the Holocaust Handbook series, that's volume number 32, the Debating the Holocaust. That's his major contribution to the revisionist sphere. So he has quite some knowledge. He contributed 8 contributions, entries to the encyclopedia within the 5 months that I was working on, which we had thought about splitting it 50-50. We had other people who initially signed up but then bailed out because of personal problems or whatever the case may be. So I contributed, I would say, 99% to the encyclopedia, and 1% is from someone else.
Well, Guillermo, let me ask you this as a step back overview question. So what you have done in the decades, and, you know, we showed at the Holocaust Handbook that you've got 50-some, I think you just published your 59th book recently. And you know, this is elite PhD-level scholarly research, right? This is not ad hominem insults. This is not so-called hate speech. This is as good as it gets when a high-level intellect decides to research a topic. And what do you consider that? Is this some type of psychopathic religious cult, this cult of the Holocaust, that these countries are going along with it and they're making viable, confirmable elite research on a topic that should be wide open to research, just like how many, you know, countless books have been written about World War I, World War II, everything, right? So why can't you and others as elite scholars research this and publish your results? It's just, is this like a globalist totalitarianism? Is this like an interim step towards like the one world religion, the one world government insanity? I mean, it just makes no sense to me that, you know, you're not going in any way ad hominem insulting Jewish people. You're not calling for any kind of violence or anything. You're just literally looking into a topic that is highly questionable, as we all know it's all lies and distortions and specious representations. So what do you think's going on? What's their agenda? And is that why you continue on to fight this dark cult agenda?
Well, first, let me bolster the statement you've made. Yeah, what we've published mainly is forensic and archival research. So you'll find primary sources, archival resources that have been mostly released only after the collapse of the Soviet Union. The reason why that research hasn't been done in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s is simply because most of the archival resources were under the control of the Soviet Union. They kept it secret or inaccessible, and it has become accessible only since the early 1990s. And actually, Russia has closed the archives to non-accredited, non-governmental researchers again. So there was just a small window of opportunity where we could get good access to it. And if you compare our studies to mainstream studies on this similar topic, ours are way on the side of more analytical, based on more primary sources and less speculation. So they are much more academic than what you'll find in the mainstream. Blows it out of the water in terms of scale and scope and depth. So there's simply no comparison. Why is it not accepted as such when it is so dry, scientific, scholarly stuff? The answer to that, I think, was found or exposed, I would say, by a German professor of sociology in the late 1970s, I think, or early 1980s. He made an experiment in a German lecture hall. He informed, it was, the whole series was a social anthropology. And at some point in these lectures, they were talking about taboos. European researchers found out about the taboo, that taboos exist, when they were investigating indigenous tribes in Africa, when you destroyed any of their holy sites or desecrated it, like being at a tree or whatever, then they just react completely irrationally and want to kill you because you're blasphemous and you've destroyed their or desecrated their, what they consider holy. And the understanding is that we enlightened Europeans don't have that kind of attitude to any topic anymore, and we have a rational approach. If somebody discusses something controversially but rationally, we all react rationally to it, right? And then he made that experience in his lecture hall with his students, right, sitting there and taking this class. He informed a couple of his assistant students to take notes and to make a protocol of what's happening. When this very professor stood up in front of his class one day and presented to those assembled students in the hall arguments of Holocaust revisionism, while there couldn't have been any homicidal gas chambers, why the mass murder claim is untrue, and why there was no plan and no systematic killing, and 6 million didn't die. The reaction of the students in this lecture hall was exactly, down to the physiological appearances of increased heartbeat, heads turning red, expressions getting furious, people being completely irrational to discuss, call for the police, call for arrest, threat of violence, exactly the same reaction of the violation of a taboo that can be or could be experienced with indigenous tribes as European explorers went into Africa, South America, and wherever else. So we are dealing with the classic phenomenon of a societal taboo in the Western world. It's as simple as that. The question is, again, how do we get there? We used to have the same in unenlightened Europe, and Europe isn't much more enlightened. It's just this, the focus of the light has shifted. It's just a new dark corner. In the medievals, when you did something to desecrate Christianity, Christ, whatever it was, then people could react that way. And we know where that came from, because 2,000 years earlier, that wasn't there. The Christian church imposed it upon people. So a political and religious power with brainwashing, with constant inculcating of the masses, and with violence, with threats of punishment over centuries, has led to people being so brainwashed that they're completely in line and now will hand over a suspected witch or sorcerer to the authorities automatically, and they're just as upset about this witch as the church is. This is the situation we have now. It didn't take them centuries. It took them just years or a few decades to get that accomplished with the power of mass media, with the control over all the things that influence people. There's only one side to the story. There is no public debate about it. The people are not being informed. There are rational arguments about why the story has been distorted, exaggerated, twisted, or some of it invented. And this is pretty much the simple background of it. Now, we can talk about who's done it. This is when it comes to taboo of the Christian church, it's very clear it has been the papacy, the Holy Inquisition at the top of it. And it's not that simple when we're talking about the Holocaust story. It is easy to say it was the Jews, but it's not that simple. If people point to the Jews, they do so because it is easy to say why they have an interest in it. Of course, the Jews were the primary scapegoat of National Socialism, and they did suffer. They were persecuted. There's no question about it. And after the war, they had an interest of, or they can be suspected to have had an interest in exploiting that for their advantage on a political level, on a financial level, on just a level of getting influence and moral dominance, the air superiority, if you wish, on the moral arena, and to finally ram down the world's throat their claim to Palestine as a safe haven from further Holocausts. All that makes sense, but it doesn't tell the full story, and it doesn't look at all the culprits. If you look at the question, who's done it, the core of the Holocaust is, of course, the story of the gas chambers. And the question is, what is the root of the gas chamber story? We're not discussing the persecution of the Jews, denial of certain civil rights, their mass deportation, locking up in concentration camps and labor camps and ghettos and all this. This is not really what is being contested. We can talk about what the reasons were, the amounts and the actual suffering and the fine details of what happened, but not about whether or not these things happened. This is not contested. The main thing that is contested here is the claimed high-tech approach of a kind of conveyor belt physical mass extermination is specifically invented and built murder tools called homicidal gas chambers. This is what sets apart this claimed genocide from all the others. You don't need gas chambers to commit genocide. There have been a lot of genocides all over mankind's history, and as a matter of fact, during this and after the Second World War, genocides happened left and right. The Jews were not the only victims of that kind of a persecution as an ethnic group. The Germans themselves were a victim of that, and a lot of Eastern populations who temporarily, to some degree or another, collaborated with the Germans, fell victim to ethnic cleansing and genocide. The whole Baltic countries, Ukraine was a victim of it. The countries in the Caucasus area, Georgia, Chechnya, Ingushetia, Dagestani, and all the rest of it, they all suffered a genocide to one degree or another, because for just a few months that the Germans were in the Caucasus, they collaborated with them and had it coming afterwards. So World War II has had genocide left and right all over the place. So what the Jews experience is not unique, but when you put the gas chambers into the equation, it becomes unique. So this is your uniquifying feature, if you wish. I created a word here. And who's done it? Who has created that story? And I've actually published a book about it that came out late last year, second edition early this year, and that is Nazi Gas Chambers. Now, I have here do you have the ability of going to armreg.co.uk, the bookstore where we actually sell the books? .co.uk. Right. Okay, go there. Why can't it not be reached? Armreg, you have an R missing after the A, like the arm. A-R. Here you go. Okay, if you scroll down a little bit, I think it's still on that page. By the way, what you see here, stop for a second, Encyclopedia del Holocausto. We just released the Spanish edition of the encyclopedia, so in quick succession, hopefully more or less, we'll be releasing other language editions. But if you keep scrolling down, you find, keep scrolling, the book there, Nazi Gas Chambers, The Roots of the Story. That goes into the actual root of this feature of the persecution of the Jews that sets it apart from any other major persecution of ethnic or religious minorities during the Second World War. And there is another big player who has pushed that narrative, who has created that narrative, I would actually say. And if I share a screen, that is, where do we have that here? Let me see.
G, your mic is muted. If you're talking.
Okay. If you look at the bottom, present, there should be a button at the middle of your screen. Present, that's how you can begin to share screen.
Yeah, I have that. I'm just here trying to figure out which one of the screens I have up here I want to share. So I have it up now. Now, we all know that the Holocaust has been and is being used by Zionists, not just Jewish Zionists, Christian Zionists just as well, to justify their land grab in Palestine.
Right.
If you look at the map here, that do you have it up for everyone to see?
Yep. It's Germany in blue, 1990, 1914, Poland since 1946. Yep. Everybody can see.
So if you merge the light blue and light green together, it was Germany in 1914 before the outbreak of the First World War. And after two world wars, the light blue one is what's left of Germany. And, of course, before the First World War, there was no Poland because Congress Poland was occupied by Russia, and the Posen area, predominantly Polish, was part of Germany. But what you can see here, that the territory that Poland consists of today, roughly half of it used to be Germany. Okay. Now, of this green territory, I would say 80 to 90% was actually populated by Germans, and the vast majority is for many centuries, though there is no historic, ethnic, cultural, whatever claim that Poland could possibly have made to claim this territory. The northern part, actually, that is not part of Poland, is now the Kaliningrad Oblast, most of it that Russia holds. I grabbed that after the Second World War. What you see here is that there is another nation who went on a huge land grab after the Second World War. They had their first land grab after the First World War. Some of it was justified because it was majorly populated by Poles, as I said, the Poznan area and some of the southern West Prussian area, but the rest of it not. And after the Second World War, what happened is that the German population of these areas was ethnically cleansed. Some 7 million Germans were driven out. And the territory that the Poles grabbed and the number of people they ethnically cleansed from this area is roughly 7 times as big as what Zionists did in Israel. 7 times as big. 7 times as much of a justification needed to do that. Okay.
Wow.
Now, how do you do that? The Second World War broke out because Poland bit off Germany after the First War more than they could chew and more than they deserved. Danzig was the major breaking point that led to the Second World War, and Danzig was 95% inhabited by ethnic Germans who were wanting to stay Germans and be a part of Germany. They were not part of Poland. It was under the League of Nations supervision, but the League of Nations was a toothless tiger, and Poland pretty much tried to do with the Danzig people what they wanted to, and tried to grab the whole city. And at the end of the Second World War, they did, and all the surrounding areas and much, much more. So the Second World War broke out because of a minor surface area that was contested between Germany and Poland. After the Second World War, that contested area had been 50-folded, 100-folded. Okay? Poland didn't just take the city of Danzig after the Second World War. They took everything up to the river of the Oder, and that was 100 times more than the city of Danzig ever was big. How do you prevent Germany from ever coming back and saying, that's not right, that's ours, you should give it back? They have triggered a war with Poland over just one city. How much more likely is that they trigger a war with Poland when Poland takes a quarter of the entire German territory? Of course, under normal circumstances, it is much more likely. Of course, under these circumstances, Germany gets back on its feet and you have World War III. How do you prevent it? You break Germany's backbone.
Right.
You make them feel so guilty that they accept everything that's being done to them as just punishment, as we had it coming. Not just for having started the war, because that wouldn't really fly. That didn't fly after the First World War. That wouldn't fly after the Second World War either. The Germans had some self-confidence left over. They could figure out the Second World War was, it started because Russia and Germany invaded Poland, and it was started because Poland was ethnically cleansing its territory that it had grabbed from Germany after the First World War from Germans, and that ethnic cleansing led to the conflict. Just like NATO declared war on Serbia because of the Serbian attempt to ethnically cleanse Kosovo. If NATO had a right to invade or declare war on or wage war, they didn't even really declare it, wage war against Serbia because Serbs were trying to ethnically cleanse the Kosovo Albanians out of Kosovo, then Germany had a right to declare a wage war against Poland for their ethnic cleansing. I'm not saying that is, but if NATO was right, Germany was right. If NATO was right against Serbia, Hitler was right against Poland. Doesn't go down well with anyone. I think war is never a good solution. NATO shouldn't have done what they've done. Hitler shouldn't have done what he has done. Besides the point, how do you get Germany to accept what was done to them? My family, by the way, my paternal side of my family came from this little dangling arrow type green area that you see at the bottom. That's Silesia. That's the Glatzer Bergland. It's a mountain area. Mm-hmm. And right at the foothills of that mountain area, that's where my paternal family lived for 700 years. They emigrated there in the 12th century. We could trace it back until then from Franconia. Anyway, if you look at which camps of the claimed Nazi extermination camps, which of the National Socialist concentration camps or any kind of camps are said to have been those where the mass murder is said to have happened, where those conveyor belt style high-tech homicidal chemical slaughterhouses are said to have been set up that had this massive amount of Jewish victims. There are six camps. If you were to locate them on the map, where do you think they are?
In the 1914 Poland area. In fact, I wanted to ask you about that. I was just reading an article this week about a gentleman who maintains that he put up a graphic of all the prison camps operated by the Soviet Union were in the green part of Poland, and then the blue camps were in Germany. And his premise was that the Soviet led this incredible disinformation campaign to blame Germany for the atrocities that the Soviets and the Poles were doing in their prison camps. Do you think there's any validity to that contention?
Yes, it's a little bit of a separate topic, even though there are areas where they intersect. Yes, so your answer was correct. All these six camps, actually, alphabetically, Auschwitz, Belzec, Chełmno, Majdanek, Sobibor, and Treblinka, they're all in this red area that you see Poland since 1946, so all of Polish / Stalinist / Moscow control. And if you look at the narrative as the mainstream pushes it to this day for all these six camps, where this was created. And this is actually something that you can already, if you know where to look for all these six camps, you look up the six camps I just named in the encyclopedia and read the propaganda history and how the mainstream narrative has been shaped and formed, you will find that all six of them were basically written, the narrative written by four individuals. Three Polish investigative judges and one Polish historian. I can name them all. Władysław Betnac for the Camp of Chełmno, Zdzisław Łukaszkiewicz for Majdanek, Sobibor, and Treblinka. What's his face? Janssen for Auschwitz and for Belzec. We have Eugenius Schroit, who is a historian. The other three are investigative judges. These investigative judges were put in that position by order of the Stalinist Polish new government that was put in place by Stalin himself. What kind of orders they got, how to rig their investigations, we don't know. But in this Stalinist era, the Soviet / Polish Stalinist communist investigative commissions, they were all rigged and they were all coming to foregone conclusions, and you can actually trace it down. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, the files in the Polish archives have become accessible, and we can see how these judges actually operated. The most egregious, the most mind-boggling case is that of Sobibor. The Sobibor camp, investigated by Judge Łukaszkiewicz, had a dozen or so, or 15 maybe, I don't know exactly, witnesses interrogated by the judge. And those witnesses kind of agreed on how murder was done. They agreed kind of that they were killed with chlorine. and that these gas chambers had collapsible floors that after the murder would open up downward and all the corpses would fall down into some trolleys running on rails underneath in a basin kind of area, and they would be then ferried off to mass graves or to open pit burning sites. That is, this peculiar setup, mechanical setup, is kind of agreed upon by the vast majority of those witnesses and those who have not stated anything in this regard. They just didn't say anything in this regard. This is completely at odds with what the mainstream nowadays tells is said to have happened at Sobibor. They said that engine exhaust gas was used, not chlorine, and that there were no collapsible floors. The people were just dragged out and carried away manually after they had died. This is the claim. Now, if you look at what Vukasiewicz eventually did after he'd interrogated all these witnesses, the account he wrote and published, he copied it over from what he had written a year earlier about the Treblinka camp. So he threw out all witnesses, ignored them completely, and copied over the pattern he had developed for Treblinka onto Sobibor. It's a complete fake, made from scratch, copied. Now, you go to Treblinka and see how he's operated there, because he has done the research for Treblinka as well. And we find there more witnesses that have been interrogated, a complete mess as to what they claim, and in particular, witnesses flip-flopping. They claim steam was used, vacuum was used, engine exhaust was used, and electrocution was used. And then there are some outliers that make even more outrageous claims. And some witnesses, they flip-flop between either vacuum or engine exhaust. And Vukasiewicz has done something similar here. There is an official government position of the Polish government in exile. They compiled a report about the Treblinka camp on the 15th of November of 1942, saying steam chambers were used with that and that setup, all based on alleged eyewitness account, very detailed. Very down to the particulars of what is said to have happened, how these buildings looked like and how they were arranged with camp maps and everything was all there. And Vukasiewicz basically took what he had there, threw out the steam chambers, replaced them with engine exhaust because there was a little bit of more of a tendency toward the end of the war saying engine is exhaust, whereas during the war you had more of a tendency of saying it was steam. And he just said, well, steam, that's not like it, that's silly. So we go for engine exhaust. Swept under the carpet is the massive contradictions and the fact that the witnesses basically were, many of them, or by the way they were actually testifying, was clear they are talking from hearsay. They have no own experience. Oh, I wasn't in that area of the camp where the mass murder happened. It couldn't be seen. You see the same pattern with Sobibor. Oh, this area of the camp where the mass murder happened, these Nazis kept it so secret. They had this fence with branches woven into the fence so that we couldn't look through it. We didn't know what was going on, but we heard and we got messages from the people working there. They sent us written messages to explain it. So all these witnesses basically say, we haven't really seen anything, testifying from hearsay. Now, Occam's razor clearly says you, if all the things you are saying is inconsistent, contradictory, or clearly opposed to any real evidence we are having, and if furthermore you consider if those camps were mass extermination camps, then the main work that would have to be done in these camps is connected with extermination. If you want to murder within a year 700 or 800,000 people and make them tracelessly disappear by burning them on open fires, the amount of labor that's needed for that, for felling trees, for arranging pyres, for digging up corpses because they are supposed to have been first dug into mass graves and then taken out again, the amount of labor is staggering. So 95-99% of the people, the so-called labor slave Jews that would have worked in that area, that's supposed to have been so secret that nobody knew anything. Then there was an uprising in the camp. And at that point, the people who had the most incentive to do an uprising, to get away, to testify, and also the Polish judiciary, the the primary incentive for them was to get the actual witness to testify in all those scams. Sobibor had an uprising too. And yet you find that the people who testify who fled successfully during the uprising are the ones who were in the tiny part of the camp, hardly any labor there, where no extermination work was being done. So everything Occam's razor says, if you use Occam's razor, if there is no evidence, no witness, and you don't know anything, and you're talking from rumor, and nobody knows anything about this camp where the extermination, where the only realistic explanation for that is that this part of the camp simply didn't exist.
That's so well stated. I want to get Zach to jump in for a second. Zach, do you have any thoughts and questions for Garamond? That was excellent. That's exactly, you laid it out step by step how they weave this entrancement for the average person. You know, some judge, oh, we all have to trust judges. And you just proved he's corrupt. And then these lies, oh, well, it was in another part of the camp and they blocked sight lines so you couldn't see it. It's like Occam's razor is the only solution to any of this nonsense. So, Zach, your thoughts, and then we'll go back to Guillermo.
No, I don't have anything. I think this is a very succinct explanation, and I would like Guillermo to continue. I'm very much enjoying your perspective on this. I've never heard someone give such a thorough excuse for why this was created, right? A lot of people will just kind of give a very simple explanation of, oh, they wanted to make a bunch of money and things like this. But this is a very good and succinct. I'm not this well-versed in the Holocaust, so to hear all this information is very enlightening from this perspective.
I'd like, Guillermo, before you go back, I'd like to get your thoughts on, you know, there is centuries of violent, vicious historical animosity between Germans, Polish, and the, you know, the Western Russian types. And so how much did this, you know, why do they hate each other so much? And how much of that, you know, century-long archetypical hatred fueled into this whole, you know, lie of the Holocaust? Because they want to blame the demon Germans, and the Germans want to blame the demon Poles, and blah blah blah. How much of that factors into all this?
The hatred between Germans and Poles that has escalated during and after the Second World War is not that old. I've learned thoroughly the history of the German colonization or population cultivation of eastern parts of Eastern Europe. When we're talking about Silesia, to give you an example, the northern border of Silesia, some of it, the northeastern part, is actually here seen as a green border down at the bottom right, has been one of the most stable borders in Europe. Silesia used to be Polish, and then there was, as I mentioned, together with a wave of immigrants that came from Germany, a wave of German immigrants coming in, and they were more economically adept and more successful in procreating, and that started in the 12th century, and by the early 14th century, Germans were vastly outnumbering the indigenous Poles. And then there was a contract between the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, as it was called back then, with the capital in Prague, and the Polish king, who was had an obligation toward. It was not part of the Holy Roman Empire, but it was kind of an obligation to pay taxes and give soldiers for armies and so forth. And the Polish king wanted to get out of that. And as a contract, they had the Treaty of Trencin, where Poland, for all future and eternity, ceded Silesia to the Holy Roman Empire, which later turned into the Holy Roman Empire of German nation, and then into just the German nation, and then later Germany. So basically, Poland ceding Silesia to Germany in 1330-something. You could go to the back to this treaty to this day, say they could never have a legal right on an international law to Silesia, because in 1330-something, they signed a treaty for all eternity. This is going to be Germany's peacefully. And ever since, this border has been there, and it really changed only in 1946. So we're talking from 1330-something until 1946, a stable border, no war, no hatred. Nationalist passions causing wars about territories based on ethnic claims, based on culture claims, attempts of ethnic cleansing or ethnic pressure, making people stop to speak their own language and forcing them to speak a different one, has really started in Europe in general only with the Napoleonic Wars. Before that, it was feudalism. Kings were waging wars, and they were interested in the people having the right religion. You know, you had this massive religious wars against between Protestants or reformists on the one end and the papal church, leading up to the first 30-year war between 1680 and 1648. But it's an ongoing process of these religious wars. People had to have a certain religion, but the kings were not interested in what language they spoke. Back then, there was no such thing as schools where people were taught a certain language. That all started only really with the nationalist passions being whipped up by by all sides in the French European conflict with the Napoleonic Wars. The French Revolution turned France into the first major republic on the continent. Ignoring Switzerland for a while, because they have been a republic since the 1500s. But that turned them into, gave them a national identity. Then they were dragged into wars because the kings or surrounding didn't like a republic and they wanted to wipe out that revolutionary force. And it all ended up in the Napoleonic Wars, where the feudalist powers in Germany could prevail against Napoleon only by appealing to the patriotic sense of the underlings, to the people they were controlling, they were reigning, and that kind of turned all of Europe into pitting the idea of a nation state against the idea of a monarchy, basically. Monarchy against democratic, nationalistic nation. Europe has never had a strictly defined borders that says left of that border you speak French, right of that border you speak Polish. You have that today. After so much struggle, world wars, ethnic cleansing and pressure, we kind of have that now. After tens of millions of people were murdered, we're finally at the point where you draw a border like the blue against green one now. It goes down the Oder River, except for Stettin up in the north. You have German on the one side, Polish on the other side. That was never the case before. That was a interwoven carpet of multicolored ethnic language and religious and national identities. That has been Europe. The monarchic approach that the Austro-Hungarian Empire had, that were by their monarchic identity, both Hungarian and Austrian, they were not nationalists. They spoke both languages. They were reigning sometimes in Budapest, sometimes from Vienna, and they had all these other nationalities in there. They had to always balance all the interests against each other. Because of it, they were weak to the outside, and division could be sowed easily in the age of nationalism, and that was Russia took advantage of, which eventually led to the First World War. But this concept of Europe, of not having a defined nation state where only one people with one language lives, but having a carpet of multifaceted things where people interact and are fruitfully inspiring people from various cultures, is something that was much more befitting and beneficial to Europe what we have gone through, or through the two phases of world wars leading to what we have today, was a huge tragedy. So the hatred between Poles and Germans started after the Napoleonic Wars, with Germany controlling, which I initially mentioned, the Poznan area, which was majority Polish. They shouldn't have had it, but you know, Poland was divided before the Napoleonic War. Napoleon won against Prussia and Austria, and therefore reinstated the Polish war state. But after the Napoleonic Wars, Poland was divided up between Russia and Germany again. Germany got a minor part, just the Poznan area, and Russia got the major part. Up to that point, there was not really any nationalistic strife, but nationalist passion had been whipped up by the call of the kings to the people to be patriots. That then suddenly Poles and Germans were pitted against each other. The Germans in the Poznan area tried to impose their own culture and language upon the Polish majority there, making it compulsory for Poles to learn German in school, or to have German as the primary language, and that didn't go down well with the Poles. So that kind of policy that leads to ethnic strife and accusation and counter-accusation of genocide and ethnic cleansing started right there after 1815, after the Vienna Congress. And it was the Prussians, back then there was no Germany as such, the Prussians who were actually the first one putting Polish minority under pressure. The shoe was then on the other foot after the First World War, when the Poles grabbed more than they deserved and they gave it back to the Germans. And then it was in the Second World War that Hitler got back what the Germans lost and took way more than he deserved, and started ethnically cleansing the areas that he thought should be German. And then the huge backlash came after the Second World War with this massive expulsion. So it is kind of a ratcheting up of ever-escalating nationalist passion that went completely out of control. We're over that now. Now, I'm saying all these things. I'm seeing, looking at this at history. I don't want any German to say, now I understand how we have been screwed out of a quarter of our territory, and now we want it back. We're done with killing each other over territory. We have the European Union. There is not really a border as you see it right now. The European Union, you can live on either side. You can live and settle and work wherever you want. If you want to go back to the land of your fathers, I could do that. If it weren't for the Holocaust denial laws, I could only spend a prison term there, either in this Polish prison or in a German prison. I don't have any interest in doing that. But basically, what I'm getting at is we're done with killing each other. The Ukrainians and the Russians still have to learn that lesson. The rest of Europe, I think, has learned the lesson. Let's stop killing each other. Let's go back to where we were before, intermingling and being friends and doing it the right way and just behaving ourselves and being European brothers and deal with the real problems we have. So I'm not saying these things to push an agenda here, a German nationalist revisionist agenda. I just want to people understand, yeah, Jews have an agenda because they want to justify the Zionist conquest, the Zionist part of the Jews at least. But when you look at the actual roots of the story, the Poles in those years, 1946, 47, 48, going forward, had a much bigger interest, the bigger stake, and they had control over everything. The witnesses, for the most part, of course, were Jews. But had those Polish judges presented the witness statements as they were, the complete anarchy, the chaos, the inconsistency, the contradictions of the witnesses as they were, had they presented them as they are, come to the conclusion, I can't make head or tail of it, this makes no sense, I don't think that there was anything going on, then the whole thing would have evaporated. No, they threw it out, cobbled together a version that sounded kind of credible, made it out of whole cloth, and sold that successfully to the world. And we're stuck with that today, to this day. And it forced down our throats by penal law in many countries.
So a quick follow-up, and then I'll let you return to your screen-sharing presentation. So what's your take then? I mean, the way you describe it, it sounds really wonderful, you know, Europe for Europeans and open borders. But the leadership of the European Union is not representative of the people of Europe. It's way more tilted towards the international Jew, the Zionist agenda. It's way more tilted towards, supporting the insanity of forced injection of illegal and immoral gene therapy, these COVID so-called vaccines. They're not vaccines. They're gene therapy, really unproven. The removing of free speech because you can't question the Holocaust. I mean, I think that if regular Europeans or noble Europeans ran the European Union, that scenario you described would be fantastic. But in my opinion, that's not the case. The European Union is enslaving the countries of Europe, and that's driving the increased popularity of nationalism and fascism. So your thoughts?
The bureaucratic reality of Europe, the monster of Brussels and Strasbourg and whatever else comes in it, is one thing. I've been talking about an ideal of Europeans not killing each other and living peaceful side by side and getting along. The policies that are being implemented by European governments and by the European commissions that are so remote from the people themselves is a completely different issue. And we would get into the political arena here, which is not really my specialty. I have my personal opinions about things, but truth told, I have also been so removed from that since I left Europe, left it behind, because unity is nice, but if it is unity, if forced by penal law, by suppressing free speech, by destroying the core of what used to make out the base of Western civilization, that is enlightenment, that is free speech. Mm-hmm. You can't have the revolution of the Enlightenment starting in Italy in the 14th century without them breaking free the shackles of the papacy, not allowing the discussion of whether the sun circles around the earth or vice versa, like Galilei. Saying, well, the moons of Jupiter revolve around Jupiter, therefore he's barely avoided being burned on the stake like his contemporary Giordano Bruno. This is kind of the situation we have here again with the authorities. We need to realize the Holocaust is in its roots, the Holocaust, the mainstream narrative roots, born out of the conflict between the ethnic strife between Poland and Germany, and used by the Soviet Union to weaken Germany and to sow discord between Poland and Germany to make sure they don't gang up against the Russians ever again in history, which didn't work out, thankfully. And but we need to understand that it is something that undermines European identity, self-confidence in general. So it's not that isolated an issue anymore. It is being used as a propaganda weapon against any identity policy that, in particular, Europeans want to do, not just Germans, but any Europeans when it talks to immigration. You know, Germany having an influx of a million Ukrainians because of the war, I don't have an ethnic problem with that. And Germany has seen a lot of influx over the decades from Greece, from Italy, from Spain, from Portugal since the 1960s, 1970s. They've mm-hmm. nicely integrated. They're European, they're Christian, they're civilized like we are, and it fits all in. That's all nice. It has to stop somewhere when you get immigration of a massive amount of people who are completely different, have nothing to do with European civilization, are from a completely different religious background, and can completely redefine what Europe stands for, and they don't want to be and they will not be integrated. If that's the case, then of course you have a right to say enough is enough, we don't want that. But when it comes to immigration policies from non-European immigrants into Europe, I also have to always remind people, and I always ask everyone involved in the discussion in that case in this moment themselves, that if you don't have the babies, somebody else does. And if you look at the population and demographic collapse that almost all European nations, European countries are going through, in the long run, you will be replaced. Now, we can again talk about why it is, and this gets us back in a circle. Why can't we have a policy that makes people embrace life? Life at its core is the creation and raising of new life in love. Because without that, there is no life. This is the core meaning, purpose of life itself. And the Western world, particularly the European countries, have lost that completely out of sight. For them is material self-realization or egocentric, materialistic, hedonistic, self-serving attitude that puts everything before having a family, having children, that has led to that disaster, and to having policy systematically reversing that course and making Europeans embrace the family, embrace children again, is what's needed. But if you then make that kind of policy decision and you're being instantly labeled as a Nazi, as a right-wing extremist, as a right-winger, we get back to the gas chambers, why those political parties are being put under pressure, ostracized, persecuted, destroyed, and this is not good. So, big topic, there must be a reason why they suppress the kind of knowledge that I offer. And it's, of course, a little bit more than ethnic strife between Poles and Germany, or even the willingness of all the former enemy nations of Germany, or the winning allies of the Second World War, to want to suppress a resurging German nationalist identity, whatever that means. There's more to it. There are so many more political interests finding it, or political groups, I would say, finding it more than convenient to use the Holocaust as a weapon to badger people that they find ideologically in opposition. Now, I don't necessarily do share this or that side. I know it is being politicized, it is being used, and I don't like that. I think history should, first of all, be accurate. Then on this accuracy, you can build reliable policy. Anything else is abuse and won't stand the test of time.
Well, that's the key. That's the linchpin to it all, isn't it? That they are actively representing falsehoods as real and gaslighting people to, yeah, you're right, I can't talk about the Holocaust, it can't be questioned. And I completely support your contention that is all history should be discussed, and there should be a relentless pursuit for understanding the truth of history, what really happened, and then decisions should be made upon that factual basis, not because of the agenda of a certain tribe or another tribe.
Right. Now, if I could bail out here and maybe get back to one point, because I always hope that there are viewers out there who are not part of the choir, not quite on board with what we are saying. And I would like to give an example of what the mainstream has already agreed to in terms of things having been exaggerated, invented.
Sure.
So the revisionism of the mainstream, of their own narrative, shown drastically in a chart that I have prepared that you also can find in the encyclopedia.
Oh, I want to bring it
on
up.
The part of the camp of Majdanek, the claimed death tolls of the Majdanek camp. A classic case of mainstream revisionism that is now much, much closer to what we claim is the truth than what the original claim was.
The graphic is now up on the screen, by the way.
Yeah. So you, in the intro to this podcast, you have mentioned that the Soviets after the war had these outrageous death toll claims. Of course, that was mainly focused on Auschwitz. We got down there from 4 million to what we are down there now. 1 million, but this is only one stage, and it has reduced it down to a quarter. A much more drastic revision is one of the six camps that I mentioned. It's the Majdanek camp. It started out right at the end of the war when it was actually the first major camp that the Red Army occupied. I never used the word liberated in connection with the Red Army because they never liberated anyone, not even inmates in camps. There were a lot of female inmates in camp that the Red Army conquered were raped, and some of the inmates who were considered to have been collaborating with the Germans were deported to Siberia. So the fate of inmates taken over by the Soviets was not always very pretty. Be that as it may, they started up the press conference a little after, I think a month after they had conquered the area, the Lublin area. They claimed that Canberra actually had 2 million death tolls, and they claimed that there were 7 homicidal gas chambers at that camp. The order of magnitude of this number stayed roughly the same, even though it was lowered a little bit. The Polish verdict of their short trial held a little later, still during the war, as you can see, kind of headed by 1.7 million. And then the Soviet Commission report, their mock commissions that they always have done for any kind of crime. See, and that's actually where that comes from initially. The Soviets have created commissions to investigate alleged German war crimes wherever they said they have found victims or traces of victims. And in some cases, it very much smells like they have located mass graves of NKVD massacres, of Cheka massacres since the Bolshevik Revolution, because we need to be aware that up to the Second World War, Lenin, Stalin, and their henchmen had murdered during peacetime. Well, the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution wasn't really peace, but it was at least not a conflict with any foreign power. Well, that's not quite true because they had a war with Poland at that time. And anyway, Lenin and Stalin together had, depending on which site you listen to, some 10 to 20 million victims of civilians, and they must be buried somewhere. They are in mass graves. Most of them have died in the western part of the Soviet Union, and the vast majority, worst hit with any disaster in this territory of the Soviet Union was always Ukraine. It wasn't just the Holodomor, the ethnic cleansing after the Second World War, but it was already the Bolshevist civil war was raging worst in Ukraine, wreaking havoc there. There are a lot of mass graves, and it stands to reason that some of them were labeled by Soviet commissions as victims of German crimes, because while they were at it, they had to explain all these things, and you could just dump it on the Germans. They couldn't defend themselves anymore and get away with it. We have a classic example of the Budenko Commission redefining who did the murders in Katyn. So we know the Katyn mass graves were discovered by the Germans in early 1943. Was a huge success for them in terms of a propaganda campaign they built on that. And that is also the point where the British started their massive counter-propaganda claim of German gas chambers at Auschwitz. It went in parallel. The Germans said, we find 3,000 murder victims in Katyn. And weeks after, the British propaganda says, well, the Germans kill 3,000 people a day in a gas chamber at Auschwitz. It's that same number just thrown back at the Germans. The Budenko Commission, toward the end of the war in Leningrad, had there was a show trial against some unlucky German prisoners of war that were blamed to have committed the mass murders in Katyn. And the Budenko Commission had re-examined these mass graves, dug out the corpses again, found German cartridges, and said it was the Germans. The Soviets actually had a lot of German cartridges because the German army was helping build up the Red Army before the war broke out, which was not a good idea, because they had a pact, the Soviet Union and ostracized Germany helping each other get back on their feet. The Budenko Commission, Budenko was leading investigator, and many more claimed crime scenes. And all these commissions, and you'll find that again and again also in the encyclopedia, coming up with outrageous claims about numbers and technologies and techniques used to kill or to eviscerate the traces of the murder victims. you see that here too. Soviet Commission report, an absolute mockery of expert reports, but they came up with 1.5 million sarin gas chambers still. War was over. Propaganda was over. I mentioned already Zitzislav Lukashkevich, who has completely invented the Soviet war in Treblinka narratives. There he is with his third camp coming up, 365,000. It is quite a downward revision. But if you look actually at the records which he had access to, the files of the Maidanek camp, he knew that this number is still vastly exaggerated. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc, another Polish historian in 2092 revised that further downward to 235. So now we are a little over 10% of the original claim of 2 million. If you do go into the actual records and you see how many people died there and what are these alleged gas chambers all about, you find that the only trace in the documentation is about planning and installing fumigation chambers. There's no trace of any homicidal activity going on. So there are no gas chambers according to the actual documents that we find. And the death toll in total, 42,000, still a lot, mainly diseases. So with all the documentation and the technical analysis, forensic analysis of the claimed homicidal gas chambers that was published by this revisionist duo in 1998 for the first time in the German language later. That is volume number 5 in the Holocaust Handbook series. So if anyone wants to look it up, holocausthandbooks.com, book number 5. You can find all the documentation. There was no real monograph from the mainstream about that camp up to that point that was worth a shot of powder. So they were put under pressure. Thomas Krantz is, to this day, if I'm not mistaken, a new generation Polish lead historian at the Maidanek camp. In an article, not a book, but an article, a longer article, he revised the number finally down from 235,000 to 78,000. So we're getting very close to the truth. So 3.9% of the original. In Auschwitz, it was a quarter. We're down lower than 4%. And he threw overboard 5 of the 7 gas chambers. When it comes to Auschwitz, they reduced the death toll from 4 million to 1 million, but they kept all the claims about the homicidal gas chambers intact. So we're talking about quite a few in Auschwitz. All in all, 7 buildings that are said to have had gas chambers. Strange enough, 7 in Maidanek as well. Anyway, in Auschwitz, they're still being claimed to this day. However, in Maidanek, they threw 5 overboard, and they have very little to stand on when it comes to the remaining 2, and they kind of agree that the vast majority of the 78,000 were not in the gas, killed in gas chambers. The gas chambers were used only sporadically and not really systematically. In other words, we can't completely abandon them, but between parentheses, they weren't used, they weren't gas chambers. But you cannot completely, as a mainstream historian, give up the claim of gas chambers, because if you do, it will have a domino effect. If one camp is shown to have had its entire narrative of homicidal gas chambers invented from scratch and is thrown overboard, how can you justify suppressing similar approaches to other camps? You can't. So you have to uphold the mirage of the gas chamber in your narrative, and it's at that point not more than a mirage, if you want to uphold the entire narrative somehow. 100% to 3.9%, only two out of 7 gas chambers left, and hardly used, that is admitted. It shows you that the revisionists, with their claim, what the camp's actual history is much, much closer to what the mainstream historian tell today than what was told by them at the end of the war. Plus, you need to always consider the historians of these museums, Auschwitz Museum, Maidanek Museum, they are very well aware during the Soviet time they could not possibly make these radical revisions, because they would have been called to held responsible for that. They said they would have had disciplinary actions, they would have lost their job, whatever that means, disciplinary actions. back then, formerly Holocaust denial, whatever that is, was not encoded as a crime during the Soviet times. 1998, the year our revisionist book on Majdanek appeared, was also the year when Poland introduced a penal law, making it up to 3 years in prison, punishable, to contest the Holocaust narrative. So under democratic Polish rule, contesting the official narrative is legally much more constrained, if not to say outlawed, in clear letters of the law and in clear threat of punishment than it was in the Soviet time. So we have kind of less free speech, formally speaking, now than they had before. Okay, why should you believe a person, a historian, a mainstream historian, who is threatened by the government, who employs him as a historian, with 3 years of prison, why would you believe that he tells the truth? When he has admitted that in decades before, they lied because the government put them under pressure of disciplining them. There's no reason. They are much more under pressure today to lie than they were back then.
Right.
When they admit, and the numbers clearly show, they have been lying all along. That's what they do. They have lied. They keep lying. They have to keep lying to keep it up.
It's just insanity, and yet they keep pushing, right? I mean, look at even in the United States, these Jews keep pushing at the state level for Holocaust education. In fact, I believe it's up to nearly 23 states have passed some of that drivel, and it makes no sense that, again, it really is like, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the corpus callosum that links the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere of the brain, and when you sever it, the two hemispheres of the brain work independently and have no idea what the other hemisphere is doing. And basically that's what we're seeing with, you know, much of the world waking up to see that the Holocaust was a lie, and it's continued to be promulgated by individuals and groups with an agenda, versus the people who are like, don't question it. This is the Holocaust is real. It's our religion. It's our cult now. It's just, it's so infuriating to me. But I mean, all we can do, and what you've done, is you're basically the little train that could, and you've got 59 books on it. It's all scholarly. And at some point there's going to be a critical moment that's going to just blow the lid off it. Don't you think?
Yes. Yeah, so when it comes to education, I'm trying to share another screen here. I don't think that Holocaust education is wrong. You just need to get the education right. The Holocaust has a massive influence on our daily lives, and it is important to get the facts straight.
Right.
Holocaust education is done in Western countries officially along the official narrative line, and it is against all Western tradition, against everything else that students are being taught at school, discouraged to be critical, to be skeptical, to question what the teacher presents you. Quite to the contrary, or quite to the extreme opposite. If you ever try, you have it coming as a student, or if it even has happened. I remember that a teacher got in trouble just for allowing critical questions, not for accepting them or going along with them, but just for allowing it. So there is a massive pressure of, this is just basically brainwashing if you discourage or even outlaw a skeptical approach to any kind of topic. What you see here on the screen is the holocaustacademy.org, which I've established recently. We now offer private tutorials and seminars to enlighten and educate people in the ropes and the basics of the Holocaust on various levels. So if anyone out there has an interest in finding out more about it and getting up to speed of revisionist research on the topic, of being firm in their knowledge if they ever get confronted, it's primarily interesting for influencers who want to tread in this territory. It is good to have good basic knowledge in order not to make false argument, which can easily be refuted by the mainstream. A lot of strawman arguments, which unfortunately some people fall in that trap. You need to be aware what they are, avoid them, and have the right arguments and make the right points in a discussion to prevail. Because most other influencers, mainstream media people, have a very superficial knowledge of the topic themselves, but they can easily find out about if you make some kind of flawed argument and then make you look like a fool. That's the last thing anyone needs. And in order to prevent people from doing that, to give everyone the information weapon they need to fight back, to really ironclad their approach in discussions. That's what we offer here. We've just launched it, and we'll see where that project goes. But it's a way of putting Holocaust education to good use, because it's needed. The topic isn't going to go away. The topic will remain massively influential, and you just need to get the right information to the right people to make sure this topic is getting less and less abused.
One quick clarification. You said .org, and it's actually .com. It comes up holocaustacademy.com.
Okay, my mistake. Sorry.
Oh, no problem. I put it in both the chats, so... you are presenting a comprehensive array of techniques based on irrefutable facts and PhD level academic research that's just amazing, and no wonder. How do you feel? You know, they being the International Jew and their vicious Shabbos goy have come after you. They've imprisoned you. They've done everything they can to make life miserable for you, and in you're in rarefied company. The same thing was done to Ernst Zundel. The same thing was done to Professor Farazan and other, you know, people who just, you cannot question your content. So they're going after you personally. I just find that despicable.
Yeah, well, the more bridges you burn behind me, the more I have to go forward.
There you go. That's a great reply. That's a great reply. We're coming down to the final 12 minutes or so. So if there's anything else you'd like to cover in the next 12 minutes, please continue. This is great.
Well, you mentioned I've published my 59th book. Now, that was the wrong figure. The Holocaust handbooks, I have published them as a publisher, or later on as a media production manager when I wasn't the publisher itself anymore. But when it comes to how many books have I authored of these, and I'm not quite sure. I am a co-author of some of them, and some I've authored myself, but I think it doesn't go beyond 10 of them, or maybe even less, be that as it may. When it comes to books that I have myself written or where I'm the lead editor of an anthology, I just published my 19th book, and I probably can put that on the screen here. The last one I released is just gotten out a few days ago.
Great.
And here is the cover of it. So if you were to go back to the OMREG website, you find this book actually displayed at the very top of that homepage. And you mentioned initially my discussion I had with mainstream historian Dr. Van at the Mike Shields Show, and what came up at that discussion, Jake threw in there the fact that, well, there's always the argument that the International Military Tribunal in Nuremberg presented a lot of evidence that bolsters the Holocaust mainstream narrative. And Dr. Van said something to the effect, yes, there was a lot of useful information presented at Nuremberg. And I went into the Majdanek issue, because the Majdanek expert report by the Soviets was presented during the Nuremberg trial, and it is completely phony. But, of course, you can't make the complete case of why and to what degree the evidence submitted to the International Military Tribunal is phony. And I knew we revisionists need to have a book that puts the main arguments why, by structural defect, the IMT was a rigged trial, and why, by the type of evidence and how the evidence was obtained, the case made by the prosecution is more than shaky. So that's what that book does. It analyzes the IMT from a legal point of view, its illegality and illegitimacy, and its flawed or highly corrupt procedural rules and procedures in general, and then goes into how the evidence that was eventually presented at the IMT was produced with these fake Soviet commissions, with the made-up Polish investigative reports, some of them I've just laid out, completely made up, that then ended up in Soviet hands and were introduced in Nuremberg, and with commission reports, Soviet-style mockeries of expert reports, and of course with a lot of torture and pressure, manipulation of witnesses. All this is now in the plain open. After so many decades, it has come out, and it just needed to be put into one volume. So if someone wants to argue, well, the IMT was not a place where the Holocaust has been proven, quite to the contrary, that's the book to go to. Holocaust proven at Nuremberg. It's reviewing the evidence presented at the trial, and it shows clearly, nope, not proven there. It's, wow, for me very convenient myself. If I ever get into a discussion again and a professor of mainstream history says, oh, the IMT proved it all, I said, nope, read this first and then we can discuss it.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Zach, you want to jump in with anything?
No, again, this is just a very extensive information, which, you know, I've maybe looked into some of the more basic things about the Holocaust, you know, such as just things that are simply disproving a gas chamber or disproving the overall numbers that are claimed. But I think you give a much more broad and extensive approach to this issue that is very important for people to hear about, because I was not familiar with, you know, just the entire narrative by basically four people, I think you stated, which is something quite shocking that the entire narrative comes from, you know, just this small little pool of source. And you can see how a lot of this has some bias behind it just in the creation. So I think this is a fantastic layout, and I've definitely soaked in a lot of information like a sponge today. So I have no questions stimulating my mind, just certainly taking everything in.
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say before we sign off here in about 7 minutes, how can people support you? What's the best way of purchasing books? Do you take donations? I mean, your work is so vital. How can interested parties support your efforts?
Yeah, I've put actually as my name down there, my personal website. And if you were to type that in, you can actually go there. The IMT book is now my 19th book, and all of these 19 books can be bought on my personal website. If you were to look at the menu there, it says signed books to the right, and you click on signed books, and then you can actually go to my small shop that I have on my personal website, where you can order my books, any combination of the 19 books that I've published over the past 35 years, and get them in a signed and dedicated version. So I order those books from our print-on-demand printer myself, get them here, put a personal dedication in there and sign it and send it to people. And they are marked up accordingly price-wise to the normal price, because it's a way for you to support me, but also at the same time get something in return for supporting me. The website itself has a donation page. If you scroll back up, if you want to just donate in general, pay and donate. Well, some people want to have an invoice to pay or donate. You can go find out the various ways that you can do that. The usual thing, credit cards in the US, you have Zelle, you have cryptocurrency and so forth. That can all be done there. Now, in more general terms, my publishing company, my employer, Armreg, is going to get mad if I don't pitch this one too. If you want to have any of these books or any of the books we talked about, the Holocaust Handbooks, the 53, the Encyclopedia, Nazi Gas Chambers, The Roots of the Story, the IMT book, or any other book that we have, you go to Armreg at a normal price. So you don't get them signed. Actually, the books on there that are offered by me, you will find a link there, a reminder. This is available as a signed and dedicated copy from the author. If you click on it, you end up back on my website with a page where you can order directly. But here you get them at a much lower price. This is a company in the UK. So currency is in British pounds. We're still trying to find a way of actually splitting about having a US and a UK store, but having one in US with the US service providers would require some organization that is down the road, whether we manage it or not. You can get the encyclopedia there as well. If you would like to have the encyclopedia ordered in with US dollars, you would go directly to the Holocaust Encyclopedia site. So we did set up something for that. There's Holocaust Encyclopedia. You had that up before, and it has the Buy Encyclopedia in the menu. And you click on that and you get the pull down menu. You can buy them right now in three different languages.
There it is right there. Deutsch, English, and Espanol.
So we have a French, an Italian, a Swedish, a Polish, a Russian, and a Portuguese edition in the works. I don't know how long they take. I think Polish and French is well advanced and may come out in a couple of months or so. For now, we have, the German one's actually not done by us. It was a completely different publishing company. I put my foot down because I don't want to get in trouble with the German authorities again. I have family in Germany, and this is a tricky situation, so I put my foot down. This is not something that I agreed to, so that was completely outsourced. But if you click on it, it goes to the other website who has done the German edition. The English and the Spanish is done by Armreg itself. And the other ones will be too. We don't want to put any other publisher in any country into trouble sure. for publishing that. So we do that ourselves.
Wow. What a great discussion and presentation from Germar. We'll have Germar back again regularly. This is vital we bring in the authors, the researchers who can clarify the hyperbole from the truth, and that's what we all want ultimately. I totally agree with what Germar said in hour two, that we should have Holocaust education, and he now has his Holocaust Academy, and this is Holocaust Academy based on facts, research, PhD level truths. There should be a massive effort to tell the truth about the Holocaust in education, not the specious representations that the international Jew wants to cement their power and their parasitic stealing of wealth over this nonsense. So again, Germar, thank you so much. God bless you. God bless Zach. God bless all of us. And it's getting crazier and crazier, that's for sure. So tune in tonight. Davis Lerman has got his 300th episode and a lot of guests, including myself, to help him celebrate his 300th episode. In an hour, Zach will be on the Stu Peters Network. Zach, Germar would make a great guest for you on Stu Peters, so perhaps you can arrange that sooner than later. And other than that, everybody have a great weekend. And tune in Monday on Base Monday Sane Asylum. It's going to be a great show with UK Steve is a big fan of Davis, and Alfred Schaefer can return. So the four of us will no doubt have a compelling discussion. So I want to thank, by the way, didn't want to disturb Germar's train of thought, but if you go to BannedByAmazon.com, Dave Gicari's new website, that all the books and DVDs and audiobooks and what have you that have been banned by Amazon from his various imprints, Money Tree Publishing, Moonrock Books, and the other ones, you can now go to BannedByAmazon.com, and he has a processor, and you can use your debit card or your credit card, and you can save 10% with the G-Man code. I'll put that up right now. And so it's great. And again, buy Germar's books, buy Dave's books. The more you can buy books, because both platforms, it's all about accurate research, accurate vetting. There's no hyperbole, no lies there. Otherwise, these gentlemen, Germar and Dave, would be sued punished, but they can't be because it's all true and vetted. And finally, if you're into crypto, Dave's got some skilled tech guys at moneytreepublishing.com. You can now buy all the books and DVDs and everything there with crypto. And again, use the code GMAN, G-M-A-N, and save 10% on your entire order. And finally, I would like to thank the donors today. Had a couple of donations. And again, don't forget, support all the hosts, because a lot of time goes into producing these shows and arranging great guests like Guillermo Rudolph. So I want to thank today. Got a donation of $19.99 from Steve-O. Thank you so much, Steve-O. You're very generous. And a donation of $10 from Colin Denzel, a new donation, gentlemen. Thank you so much. Really, all the hosts truly appreciate donations. It eases the pain of hours and hours of research and everything that good hosts do to present original content. All right, so that being said, tune in about an hour for Zach on the Stu Peters Network, which will also be found at ftjmedia.com. And a little later tonight, you'll find Flood. You'll find the brilliant Nick from Night Nation Review. And of course, don't forget Davis Lerman's 300th episode tonight, and there'll be a lot of us participating to help him celebrate it. So that being said, thanks so much for tuning in. Hope you have a great weekend, and God bless us all.